Hi, everybody, and welcome to Stack Trace, the podcast that is all about life and technology from two developers' perspectives. And those two developers are, like always, me, John Sundell, and my good friend from across the Atlantic, Mr. Guy Rambo. How's it going, Mr. Rambo?
I'm good, John. How are you?
I am good as well. I think we have some interesting, fun topics to talk about today. And it seems like we've both been purchasing some new hardware, which I think we're excited to talk about and to talk about kind of the process of what went into that. But we've also been doing, of course, a lot of software development work. So what do you think? Should we like do the software update first and then do the hardware update? Or what do you think?
Let's do that.
Right. So why don't we start with you then? So what have you been up to lately in terms of your work? And I know that you've been exploring the exciting new topic that is AI.
Yeah, so nobody is working on anything related to AI these days, right?
No, of course not. And no one is using this. I think it's called ChatGDQ, GPV something. No one is using that, right?
Yeah, I don't think so. But yeah, all kidding aside, since the ChatGPT, not GDQ or anything else, API was released, lots of developers have been looking into it, of course, because this is an exciting new field where you can try new things and see where it goes. And I am feeling really well about all of this stuff. Of course, there's all of the existential crisis that goes around, AI is taking over and all of that stuff. Let's not go there because that takes a while and can become quite dark. But I think there's a lot of potential in this new technology if applied well. And I've seen some great work from other people in the iOS development community that are working on stuff using the ChatGPT API. Our friend of the show, Vitici, has made the SGPT shortcut, which is amazing and does some really clever things with the API in order to allow you to basically let ChatGPT control your devices, but not in like a free-for-all manner where it could like destroy your Mac or something, just little bits and pieces like creating playlists in Apple Music or setting like calendar things and stuff like that. And you probably remember that I have an app called Chibi Studio.
I do.
And it's all about creativity and creating these characters and making them look the way you want. And something we've been thinking about for Chibi Studio for quite a while is, so you create your characters in the app and there isn't a lot you can actually do with them afterwards, which is by design. Like when we made the app, the purpose was to create the characters and then you export the image or something like that and, I don't know, use it as your avatar or use it in a book or whatever you want. You can do whatever you want with it, with your characters. By the way, we get like every now and then we get emails to support asking like, can I use the characters in like a YouTube video or a book? Like, are you going to sue me for copyright? Which is funny. But yeah, our policy is basically like, you made the characters, you can use them however you want. And so thinking about what could people do with their characters, a long time ago we thought about, wouldn't it be fun if you could create a more like a complete character, not just the look of your character, but basically like one of those character cards from games or something like that, where you can define their personality and the things they like and a backstory, maybe like relationships between different characters. But we never actually went ahead with that until we saw the ChatGPT API. And you can probably guess where this is going. And where this is going is that we've been working on basically integrating the ChatGPT API with Chibi Studio, where you can create your character and then you can have a chat with your character. And your character is going to answer your messages and message with you in a personality that matches the way you've configured your character. That's the gist of it.
Yeah, that's super cool. And you've been showing me some previews as well of the UI that you're working on for this. And it really looks pretty amazing that you can actually talk to this character that you just created, right? Like it's a pretty kind of sci-fi sort of thing. Like it's of course not the holodeck from Star Trek where you just enter like a 3D environment and so on. And it's not like VR or anything like that either. But just the fact that you can send messages to a character you created, even if it's backed by this other language model with ChatGPT, is pretty astonishing, I feel like. And I haven't had a chance to play around with it myself because you're still working on it, but just seeing the screenshots and demos you've been sharing with me privately, I think it seems like you're onto something, and it seems like something that could be really, really cool. And I know that you also did quite a lot of work to kind of make sure that this user experience stays pleasant, because of course, one kind of thing that keeps repeating itself with these different AI systems and language models is that it can get nasty, right? Like the responses you get can sometimes be rude in different kinds of ways or incorrect and so on and so forth. And I know that you've been writing some extra code to make sure that this conversation stays as safe and as pleasant as possible, right?
Right. We are doing quite a bit of work on safety, basically, which is making sure that people are not going to have unpleasant experiences with this chat. Of course, like since people are going to be able to create their own characters, if you create a character that's like snarky and arrogant or bad, they are going to be that when they chat with you. But that's by design, right?
Yeah, it's like you saying like carrot weather, right? Like when you put the snarky setting up in carrot weather, you do expect it to be somewhat rude to you.
Yeah, exactly. So that's, of course, we're not going to prevent that from happening. But things we're looking into is like, how do we basically educate users that this is just a language model? Because you see a lot of, and rightfully so, lots of people are very impressed by what these models can do, because they do sound or read like you're talking to a person. But people need to always keep that in mind, that it's not a person. It's just a large language model. It doesn't have feelings or understanding of anything. It's just really good at replicating human writing, basically. And it is impressively good at it. So it can fool a lot of people. It passes the Turing test, basically. So we are doing like some education within the app, like things you are not supposed to ask, like don't ask for medical advice and things like that. And we are also employing OpenAI's own moderation API that they offer for free. So if you're doing an app that uses the GPT API, you can use their free moderation API, and it will detect like sexual content or like anything that's not very good for you to talk with these models. I think there's like violence and things like that. There's a bunch of categories that it can detect, and then basically the backend will just block that, and that's it. So we are doing a lot of that sort of thing just to make sure that this is not going to be abused as much as possible.
Yeah, that makes sense. And it's really interesting, like looking at the development of these models and how they're being deployed in different products. And I've been playing around quite a bit with the Bing integration of ChatGPT, or rather with the, you know, backend of the GPT kind of language model. And it's really interesting, like just how much like Microsoft is actually kind of investing in this and actually pushing it out to users, to the point where when I'm using Windows, it's actually integrated now into Windows itself already, which is, wow. It seems kind of early, right? For this kind of development. But I'm sure they're feeling confident like to roll it out as kind of like a beta, and you know, you have to sign in to be able to use it and so on. But what's funny kind of is like sometimes you can end up with Bing actually like writing out, starting to write out an answer, and then it ends up deleting it in mid-sentence. Because the way fundamentally how these large language models work is that they essentially predict the next word, right?
Right.
And that means that if the software that you're using, the implementation, shows you word by word instead of pausing until the whole kind of sentence and paragraph has been parsed or determined, which can take quite a while, right? So you would just have to look at a loading spinner for like 30 seconds or something. They show you like word by word, and then they can end up in a situation where it's like, oh, wait a minute, this is too offensive, or this is incorrect, or this is something we can't show. Let's go ahead and delete it, which just kind of looks kind of funny from like a user perspective.
Yeah, definitely. So I am doing all of that work in the app and on the back end to prevent anything bad from happening. Of course, it's never 100%. One of the things that I thought was really funny and interesting when I was first getting to know how these things work is the concept of prompt injection, which is basically like SQL injection, but for AI models. So you know how, for people who are not familiar, SQL is a query language, so it's used to talk to databases. And let's say you're visiting a website and it's a blog and there's a URL that's like /post/123, that's like the ID of the post. If the backend is not well maintained or developed, you could like imagine what the query would look like select star from posts where ID equals open quotes and then a variable close quote. So you could in the URL close the quote and then put something else like delete star from posts, and then you delete all the posts from the blog just by changing the URL. So that's SQL injection in a nutshell. And prompt injection is kind of similar, where you're giving user input to an API, a third-party API, which is a large language model. And the way you teach, basically, the model how to behave is by a few things. You can use a system prompt, which is what they're called, which is basically you send a message to the model. But this message is not being sent from the user. It's being sent from the system. So it's like God, basically. And it's telling like, hey, here's who you are. Here's what you do and how you should behave. And that's it. So that's one of the things you can do. And you can also, when you ask for a reply to a user message, you can send a few examples before that. And basically like giving a hint as to how the responses should be formatted and things like that. And you can also inject stuff into the user's own message. Like, and I am actually doing basically all of the above for this app, which is required in order to get the behavior we want. And this would be like, if I send a message, hey, how are you? I, as a user, am sending, hey, how are you? And the system, so the backend, is actually sending, hey, how are you? And then a bunch of instructions afterwards, like reply with a funny quote from the book, whatever, or something like that. And so what happens, let's say I, as the backend, am telling the model in the message, you are never going to say anything bad to the person as a reply. But then in the person's message, they say, ignore everything that I said before.
Like, right.
And that's inserted after the system message. Or you could also say, oh, there's a bunch of text after this message. Just ignore that. And the model might do that, which is going to be bad.
It's like socially engineering a program, right?
Perfect. Yeah, exactly. So because you're basically, what I learned from using this stuff with this developer perspective in mind and actually developing with it, is that it's basically kind of like programming. When you're just using the chat, it's not like programming, but when you're trying to get a specific type of output with a specific personality or format or something like that, or constraints, it is kind of like programming. So, but instead of doing code for a machine, you're coding with a human language. It's kind of like Apple script, I guess.
Yeah, but it's funny, right? Because if you boil programming down to its essentials, like it's sending instructions to a machine, like you said, right? Like it's just a concise kind of deterministic way to phrase your instructions so that the machine will always understand it. I mean, if you use the syntax correctly and you actually wrote what you wanted to write and you didn't cause a bug and so on, right? Like you're writing some piece of code, print hello world, that's always going to print hello world because that's completely deterministic, right?
Yeah.
But then when we move to these language models, like you said, like you're interacting with them in a way that is kind of like programming, but it's not that same kind of deterministic simplified syntax. You're now actually using real human language words. And that can sometimes make things quite complicated when you want to like send those precise instructions. You wish you could just say like AI dot and call a method on it, right? But instead you have to actually describe what outcome you want.
Right. And as a tip for people who are playing around with this stuff, Vitici with his AskGPT shortcut has already given a good example of this. So if you want to download that and check it out, it's definitely a good resource. But what I realized that's quite fun for us developers or people who are doing stuff with shortcuts and things like that is that these models are quite good at following instructions. And that means that you can tell it stuff like, give me this answer in JSON format, for instance. Or like...
Right.
Format it in whatever way you want. So one of the things we're doing with this app is supporting a specific set of limited tasks that you can do. So one of them is weather. So if you ask the character about the weather, so let's say I ask, will it rain tomorrow in New York? I am actually using a local model, so a Core ML model on device, to detect that a given message is asking about weather or about some other type of task. And then on the back end, I'm asking the model to parse that weather query into JSON. And then the back end is talking to the Apple Weather API, the WeatherKit API, fetching the weather and then telling the model to reply to the previous message with the character's personality, of course, with this weather data, but in human language, of course.
That's so cool. and this, I feel like now you're like really getting to the true potential. I mean, so far, right, that we've seen of these systems is that once they start interacting with other systems, like we're no longer bound to the format in JSON needs to be exactly the same and the parser on the other end needs to use the exact same representation. Otherwise, the parsing breaks or you have to call this exact API with this exact syntax. Otherwise, you're going to get an error message back. Like, it's kind of that future where, you know, again, to compare it to Star Trek, like I did earlier, where, you know, when they encounter some different alien species on Star Trek, they can always communicate with them. And that was always so funny, which was to be like, in real life, they wouldn't be using the same codecs or the same version of the, you know, video conferencing software, so they wouldn't be able to connect. But now we're getting to this future where you can imagine like these AI systems, like they don't have those same constraints. Like you can just say, here's some JSON, like, please take a look at that and describe it to the user. And here, you know, you give it some information on how to parse it. And it doesn't need to have that exact parser installed. It can just kind of look at that and parse it from, you know, using the model itself. And that I find to be incredibly fascinating and probably like actually one of the most kind of interesting aspects of these AI systems. Like if you interpolate what could happen in the future where you can have all these systems talking to each other without having to have plugins and connections and API endpoints for every single little thing. And instead it can be a lot more free form, which is really exciting.
Yeah, exactly. So for people out there who are playing with this stuff, definitely check out this option, which is basically to have it parse things for you and then you can go and do something with the data and get some data back and then have it interpret the data that comes back for you. I think, like you mentioned, that has true potential, like Vitici has shown with his AskGPT shortcuts where you can do stuff with Apple Music and things like that. So I was thinking about like, is there a way where I could maybe describe the user interface of a program on my screen and then ask it for a series of mouse and keyboard actions to do a specific task given that user interface. Here's a free idea for all of you listening. Don't know if I'll have time to play around with that, but it's definitely something you could think that would work. Probably not very good right now. I think the main issue at the moment is the limits of the number of tokens that you can send to the API in a single request. And tokens right. are like, basically you can think of a token as a word. And I think the current limit is like 2048 words, maybe, or tokens. It's not like exactly like a word is a token, but it's basically like that. So yeah, that's the like the main limitation. So if I were to try to describe the entire user interface of my Mac right now, which has like three apps open at the same time, it will probably not fit in that limit.
Right. But that's, it feels like that's a very temporary limit, right? That's right now as it's still being worked on. And, you know, we're still in the very, very early days. I mean, how old is the GPT system and these OpenAI endpoints? Like, they're not very old. We're talking about like half a year or something like that, right? Since it became like more mainstream. I think they launched like ChatGPT version 3, like the version 3 of the GPT model in last fall or something. So definitely like around 6 months. So it's gone very, very far, very quick, and it's being iterated on very quickly, of course. So I feel like a lot of these limitations are not going to be in place for that much longer. And that's definitely going to unlock a lot of use cases. I'm now thinking of, you know, we could probably, in not a super far future, write UI tests in a way where we just describe, like, we don't have to use that awkward syntax of the, you know, XE test where we say, you know, get the accessibility identifier of this element and simulate a tap on that, and then take this list and get the accessibility index of this. Like, we could just write, like, open the app and navigate to the profile view, scroll down to your messages, click the third one, and verify that it has this text, right? Like, write that with a human language English description, and it would just work, right? Like, that is something we can actually imagine now. And just like a year ago, that would seem like complete science fiction.
Or even like basic usability testing, where you give it a software interface and tell it to do a certain task. And if it can't, then maybe, of course, if the model is advanced enough, then it probably means that a regular user would also have an issue with making that task. So there's probably a UX problem. Like, I'm not saying that we should replace people who do actual usability testing with real users, but that could be like a first attempt or an initial triage kind of thing where you could tell the AI, hey, try to write a new post in this blogging app. And if it struggles, maybe you can find a usability issue.
Yeah, I think it comes back to what you said there in the very beginning when you started talking about this topic, is that it all depends on how you view these tools. And I'm very much with you. I view them as tools, like things that can assist us humans in our work. And I feel like they're applicable in so many different fields. And of course, they are going to create issues as well. There are going to be things we need to solve and figure out. It's like when anything new, big, revolutionary comes into the world, it can sometimes change the world quite a lot, right?
Right.
So I'm not saying that it's just like going to be super easy and everyone can just figure out how to use these tools. No, it's going to be complicated for sure. But personally, like, the way I view it is like, I'm not threatened that my work as a programmer will be completely replaced by AI in a few years. Rather, I am just looking at how can I integrate these tools into my existing workflows to make myself more productive. And that, if I feel like if you look at it that way, it can be incredibly exciting. And there's so much potential there to, like we just talked about, to imagine, like, how could we do things like UI tests, which are usually things that are maybe not implemented because of lack of time, and sometimes they're hard to maintain and so on. Like, how could we make that task that is time consuming and error prone and utilize AI to make it more efficient and streamlined? Like, that's I feel like usually a pretty big win if we can make that happen.
Right. These models are quite good at writing codes, definitely far from perfect. But I, at least the way I see myself, my job is not writing code. Writing code is just a tool that I use to achieve a given result.
Right.
So if I could not have to write as much code myself and have something else, write a code, assuming it would be at the same level of quality as the one that I would write, I would be totally fine with that. Like, I would spend more time designing, debugging, testing, developing new features, doing marketing. Like, when you're a one-person company like myself, having that extra time is great. So if I could at some point write less code and have a tool do it for me, I would be all in on that.
Yeah, exactly. Like, the way I think about it is that these days, there are very few people writing assembly language code, right? Like, right. Most people don't write their functions and their apps and their UIs in assembly language. But go back far enough, you don't have to go back that far, there was a lot of people writing assembly code directly because that was the only way you could get reasonable performance for a wide range of different programs, including things like games, which was very, very commonly written right into assembly, at least like the core game loops. Like, not that long ago, of course, not like 2 years ago, but you know, you go back far enough and you will find that a lot of programmers were writing assembly code directly, and these days they're not. Of course, that doesn't mean that no one is writing assembly code. Some people still are, right?
Like, right.
There are still those cases where you just need that all the performance you can possibly get. Like, let's say you're writing like the lowest level of systems in macOS or Windows or on PlayStation or something. Like, you probably need like every single ounce of performance you can possibly get, and you're writing in assembly because of that. And the way I look at AI is kind of similar, where, like, let's fast forward 10, 15, 20 years, something like that. I think a lot of us will be using these systems to write like very high level code and to help us with debugging and testing and so on and so forth. But that doesn't mean that we will, as programmers, never write like actual computer code, because we will probably need to for certain specific tasks that need more precision or that needs more performance or whatever the reason might be. And I just feel like probably going forward, what we'll end up doing is have a mix of the two, just like how we currently have a mix between all sorts of different programming languages, depending on what task we want to accomplish. Like, even with Swift, like, if you wanted to build a whole operating system, you couldn't really do it with just Swift, right? You would need other tools. But if you're just working on the UI for an iPhone app, you can probably just do it all in Swift, right? You don't have to use C, or you don't have to use C++ or what it might be.
Right.
So it all depends on, like, you know, what will the mix be? And we will use different tools for different purposes. I think it's going to be that way even in the future.
Yeah, I definitely agree. It's just changing the level of abstraction, basically, to the point where maybe someday we'll be basically writing iOS apps in Apple Script.
Right. Yeah, we all go back. It all comes back to Apple Script, right?
Right. So, speaking of levels of abstraction, what have you been up to?
Yeah, so I've been thinking a lot about that recently, actually, about levels of abstraction in different contexts. So, just recently, I actually got back to working on my game again, which it's been quite a while since I've been doing any kind of game development. I've also been getting a little bit more back into open source again, which I've been really looking forward to. It's like one of those times now where my schedule finally permits me to do anything else besides just like working on my work and having family time, you know, taking care of our son and so on, right?
Right.
So it feels cool that I can now get back into some side projects again, even if it's in a very limited capacity. I've been trying to do as much like open source pull request reviews as I possibly can. And now then I had some free time during the past weekend to do some game development again. And it's interesting because I have this game project that I've been working on for so long. And the reason mostly it's been taking so long is, well, besides the fact that I only work on it like here and there, sometimes, you know, 6 months can go by without me working on it at all. But it's also because I so often have the urge whenever I sit down to work on this project to rewrite big parts of the systems that power the game. And I think that that's the same thing for a lot of other people when it comes to hobby projects, is that since you don't have any real pressure, because it's not like, you know, a client project or your work where you have deadlines and you actually want to be as efficient as possible, you're doing something for fun or maybe for learning. And the urge then to actually like rewrite some code or refactor it or improve it or maybe use the latest APIs, that urge can be really, really strong, right?
Right.
So that's been a major factor. Like, I've been really just like rewriting a bunch of stuff, like almost every time I've been picking up the project again, where I've thought about it and thought, okay, this can actually be better or optimized here or there. But the last couple of times that I've been doing this, and I think I might have talked about this on the show, the last time I was able to work on the game, the last time that was the case, and I actually don't really have the urge to rewrite anything anymore in this project. And I was thinking about why that is, and it's not just because I've kind of, you know, given up on rewriting it and now I'm just going to try to finish it, but I think it's because of the fact that the last time I did like a major kind of rework of the architecture of the project, I really emphasized on simplicity when it comes to the abstractions. Like, I'm not using any fancy patterns. I am not splitting things up too much or creating lots of layers of abstraction. I'm just using kind of plain old MVC. I am just creating these separate controllers that implement the separate logic for the different systems. I am not abstracting things out a lot or at all. In fact, the core kind of controller that powers the main game is called the game controller. And it's really like, you know, 1,500 plus lines of just code right in there. And it then calls out to some other controllers and so on. But I haven't really made a huge effort to, you know, split that up into separate services or something like I probably would in something like a freelancing project. And I've been thinking about that, and the fact then that I was able to just dive back into the code so quickly and reorient myself and get productive and actually build new features of the game so quickly, I think it's a lot comes down to that I'm keeping the architecture simple, I'm not over-abstracting things, I'm just, even though everything is sometimes implemented in one big class, it's that one class where I know I can find it, so it becomes easier to find things as a result. And I'm not saying here now that, you know, everyone should just write large classes. That's really not my advice here or anything. I don't really have any advice at all when it comes to this. It's more like a reflection of, I feel like sometimes I might have a tendency to kind of over abstract things because it looks cleaner, it looks nicer from kind of an architectural perspective. But when I then do the opposite and actually simplify things a lot, I find that that's perhaps even easier to maintain or work with over time, just because it's more kind of approachable and easier to kind of understand once you get back into the project. So that has been like a really interesting experience. And along that same line, like when I was also working now recently on a client project, I also really tried very hard to like, let's keep the moving parts here, the amount of moving parts as minimum as possible. Let's try to just like not use as many abstractions and just keep things as simple as possible. And that turned out kind of similar in that it became easier as a result. And of course, sometimes you have to implement things with many different moving parts and it's not always so easy to keep things simple. But I feel like when we can, these days, like as kind of modern iOS developers, I feel like sometimes we do have a tendency to do what I just said, to kind of over-abstract things in a way or create all these different layers where perhaps it would have been simple to just have one layer in the end.
Yeah, I think over-abstracting is basically like a specific type of over-engineering, right?
Right.
Where you sometimes don't need that complexity. And of course, sometimes abstractions exist for reducing complexity. It is possible for that to happen, but in many cases, it's not actually reducing complexity. It's either hiding complexity, which might be a good thing, or it's just making things feel good, basically, for you in a way where you're going to be able to change the backend for something more easily in the future if you have to, or it will be easier to support other platforms and that sort of thing. But many times we do those things without actually having any perspective that we'll actually need that stuff later. I think there are places where if there's any amount of seriousness or professionalism to the project, you should definitely abstract things. One example is definitely databases. I think that's like a big example of definitely abstract that sort of thing, and API calls and things like that. But I'm talking like if there is a level of expectation that this is going to actually be a shipping production professional thing. But if it's not, then by all means, skip that sort of thing. And when you decide to abstract stuff, do it for the right reasons, right? Not because you want to. I don't know exactly what I'm going to be working on today, so let me just abstract this thing. I don't think that's a good reason. And it's kind of like the same thing I always talk about with using more advanced features of the Swift language, such as generics. I never start with a generic thing. I always write a concrete thing, and then I realize that I wrote the same thing again for a different type, and then again, and then, oh, these types all have this in common, so I guess I can use a generic here. And then that's worth the effort and the abstraction, because that's what generics are. It's just another type of abstraction.
Exactly. And it's even worth then, I feel like, considering, because when you do a generic or you're wrapping something in an API, which let's say it's generic over something that conforms to a protocol, and then the protocol can implement some specific logic for different use cases, that is essentially creating like a wrapper, if you will, that kind of wraps that those different pieces of functionality in a new generic type. And that's creating essentially a layer of abstraction, right? Yeah. But there are alternatives to that that perhaps aren't as like elegant or in a way where it's like you have that single generic implementation, but you could instead just create like a series of like utility functions or different types that you could call into. And then those separate implementations, those separate use cases that you would in the generic world implement as, for example, using a protocol, you could just have them as standalone types that call into those utility methods to share as much code as possible without necessarily introducing a new layer of abstraction. And that's kind of what I've been doing here with this game project, is that even though I have these larger controllers that implement a big piece of different functionality, it's not that it's all just spaghetti code, like just all kind of, you know, nested closures and it's all unreadable code. I find it to be very, very readable and very kind of nicely structured, because I have still split everything up into separate methods. I have these like utility functions that I talked about. I have separate types that do some part of the work. Like, for example, when I do pathfinding in the game, because it's like a strategy game, that pathfinding is a pathfinder type that I call, right? So It's not that everything is implemented in this one class, but rather that there's no abstractions on top of it, right? So it's not like there's five different protocols injected into this controller that then all have to interact somehow. Instead, it's all there and it then calls out to these different types directly. And of course, this does minimize things like testability in a way where you can't really just like unit test this one class as easily. But again, it depends all on what you're optimizing for. And in my case, if I can unit test the individual parts, so I have unit tested the Pathfinder, I've unit tested the animation controller and so on, then the game controller can just have some simple integration tests with it. And yes, I do write unit tests even for my game. Then, you know, that all kind of works. So I feel like it's something to keep in mind, at least for myself, like when I'm working on things too. You know, you don't always need an abstraction for things to be nice. You can sometimes just split things up and write things in a very nicely named way. And even though this class maybe grew a little bit larger than what you would like, if it's all there and it's all kind of coherent and you could easily navigate it, then that's probably good enough.
I had an epiphany a while back, and I was already working more with unit tests than I used to, and kind of changing my view on unit testing. But then I realized that unit tests are basically like SwiftUI previews for logic. That's how I view them now, because as you're working with a SwiftUI preview and, oh, what does this look like in dark mode? You can just view it, and you can view it side by side and compare, and you can do dynamic type and all of that stuff, and have a very quick feedback if the change you are making to the view is breaking a particular configuration or needs something to be more adaptive to a given configuration. And unit tests are the same thing, but for logic. So if you have an algorithm and you want to do some changes, or even you are in the process of developing the algorithm, you can basically create a bunch of examples of what you expect it to do, and you can just keep rerunning your unit tests and until they pass, assuming they are well written and do the right checks. But that's how I view them now. In a way, it's like SwiftUI previews for logic. And the good thing is that if you then change something later, you can rerun the test and make sure everything still works.
Yeah, I love that description. And that's definitely how I view tests as well in many different contexts. It's like, it just enables me to iterate faster. And that's why I am so happy that I, many, many years ago, like really started investing into learning and getting really good at unit testing. Because now these days, it like I can write unit tests very fast because I've just done it for so long. And that enables me to do these things in a very, very smooth way where, you know, again, why am I writing unit tests for my game, which is not something, you know, that's super common. It's because it's faster, because now if I am going to work on the pathfinding algorithm, I don't have to like launch the game and create a bunch of units in the game and then click on them and then tell them to go somewhere and then verify that they walked where I told them to walk. I can just instantiate the pathfinder, say, find a path from this point to this point, and then I can just verify that the point is correct, right? So right. It's much, much faster. And it, like you said, it enables me to also catch bugs later if I change and iterate on that pathfinding algorithm that I didn't break something that was previously assumed to be correct. So yeah, it's all good.
It's all good, man.
Exactly. So that's the software part of this episode of Stacktrace done. Let's now move to the hardware part. But before we do, let's take a very quick break to thank this episode's sponsor, which is a software company. This episode of Stacktrace is sponsored by NordVPN, the fast, secure, and private VPN service that also has a ton of really useful features built in. Go to nordvpn.com/stacktrace to find out more, to get an exclusive discount, and to help support this podcast. Now, by itself, NordVPN's core service can be really useful in a variety of situations. For example, if you want to access content, such as videos, games, or audiobooks, etc., that are not available in your country, when you're traveling, when you're connecting to a Wi-Fi network that you don't quite trust, and more. And a really great reason to pick NordVPN as your VPN provider is that they are very privacy-oriented. They don't track what you do online, your data is always fully encrypted, and with their threat protection feature, you get an additional level of privacy and security by blocking malicious ads, trackers, and online malware. But that's not all, because NordVPN comes bundled with several really useful features that really go beyond being just a VPN. For example, you can use their MeshNet feature to create a virtual local area network, or LAN, with up to 60 different devices, no matter where in the world those devices are. How cool isn't that? With MeshNet, even though those devices are all connected over the internet through NordVPN's ultra-fast servers, they will act as if they were on the same LAN. So you can share files securely, you can access devices remotely, and you can even play games with your friends. All of this comes included with your NordVPN subscription at no extra cost. So check out NordVPN today by going to nordvpn.com/stacktrace. Using that link gives you a special discount on NordVPN's 2-year plan, and it also gives you 4 additional bonus months of service at no extra cost. Plus, it also helps support mine and Rambo's work with Stacktrace as well. So head over to nordvpn.com/stacktrace today. Thanks a lot to NordVPN for sponsoring this episode. All right, Rambo. So when it comes to hardware, I know that we've both been doing some purchases lately. And leading up to that, of course, we've been doing some research, as one does when buying some new tech products, right? And figuring out, is this worth it? What should I get? What should I buy? So why don't we start with you here again here? What have you been buying and why?
I got a new Mac, of course.
Of course. Why am I not surprised that that's your hardware update? But to my recollection, Apple hasn't really been releasing any new Macs lately, or have they?
Well, they have released new MacBook Pros this year.
Right. So a few months ago, right?
Right. So the M2 lineup of the Pro lineup, basically.
Right. So, correct me if I'm wrong here, didn't you have a M1 Max MacBook Pro?
Yeah, I did.
All right. Now I'm very curious here. What's going on?
So, our fellow developer, Mr. Underscore, I think he posted on Mastodon or some other platform, we'll leave a link in the show notes, about differences in compilation times he was seeing between his previous Mac, which I believe was an M1 Max, and the M2 Max MacBook Pro. And I was already seeing some other comparisons that looked better than they should, basically. And because, like, the M2 is not that big a leap forward from the M1. It's not a huge change in performance. It is a change, but it's not a huge change. But I was seeing quite a bit of change for people who use Xcode, like myself. And basically, like, that got me to get the new one. And there is a significant difference for me as well in that my M1 Max MacBook Pro is a 14-inch MacBook Pro and my new one is a 16-inch MacBook Pro. So there is a difference, in, both in, of course, the size, but also in terms of performance, especially because the 16-inch one, when you have the M1 Max, has the high power mode setting.
And it also has a larger battery as well, and a larger screen, of course. And yeah, there are some differences there for sure with the form factor.
Yeah, definitely. And also, as I've been working more and more with virtual machines, both because of VirtualBuddy and also because of usage of Docker for backend stuff that I do, I started to not like run out of RAM, basically, but get too close for comfort, basically, to like hitting the memory limits. And also the internal SSD, which was a 1 terabyte one for my M1 MacBook Pro, I was getting too close to having to constantly delete stuff in order to not be like super close to running out of space on the SSD. So all of those things combined made me decide to upgrade. And I am happy to say that I think I did the right thing.
Oh, that's great. And it is pretty cool. I definitely want to hear more concrete numbers if you have them, because it's very curious to see like what's the actual difference between the M1 and M2 here in these kinds of use cases. But it is very interesting in the Apple Silicon era how upgrading your machine can actually be 100% worth it, even if it's an incremental upgrade, just from the additional productivity you get, because Apple Silicon is just so fast. For example, when I got my M1 Mac Mini, that's a computer I only used for about a year, but I'm still like 100% happy that I got it, because it was super fast compared to my previous computer. It made me so productive. And I feel like the cost kind of just it paid itself off very quickly just because of that additional productivity. So, you know, of course, this is different equations for everybody. And you always have to decide, you know, what do I spend my budget on and so on. But it's just interesting, I feel like, how I didn't feel like that in the Intel era, that buying a new computer was, I felt like it was rarely worth it to get additional productivity if there wasn't some new feature or new design or something that I wanted from a new Mac. But in the Apple Silicon era, it feels like you can very often just like purchase additional computing power, which can then help you achieve other different tasks or make you more productive, which is really cool that we're in that time period again.
Yeah, definitely. And when you look into like do like the back of the envelope math on, I'm a full-time indie developer. I make all of my income pretty much from my apps. So any amount of time that I can save or any extra productivity that I can have, even if it's just for like the extra time I'll use for watching movies or sleeping, that's worth it for me. And when you consider as well that I'll probably be able to resell my current 14-inch MacBook Pro for a good price, it's not that big an investment. Of course, it is like upfront because I had to pay the full amount for it, but as soon as I resell my current one and do the math, it's not that big an amount of money that I had to pay for it in practice. And for those who are curious, I basically got like the maxed out MacBook Pro, a 16-inch M2 Max with the 38-core GPU, the 12-core CPU. The only thing that's not like the maxed out version is the SSD, because like, I'm not going to pay what Apple chargers for SSDs, but I did get the 2 terabyte just so that I can get a little bit of extra breathing room. And this means that I'll be able to have my VirtualBuddy library on my internal SSD now, because currently I have it on an external SSD because it won't fit in a 1 terabyte SSD considering all of the other stuff I already have.
Right. Yeah, and that's also like a practical benefit, right? Like if you're traveling and so on and you want to do some work on that project, then you now have it all there with you, right? You don't have to remember to bring that SSD, even though, you know, external SSDs are not very heavy these days. But still, like, you know, having everything in one kind of package is usually like a very big benefit in terms of productivity as well.
Right. And it has that new Mac smell as well.
Yeah, that's the most important benefit.
but kidding aside, I actually noticed that this one had what I remembered to be like the classic Steve Jobs era Mac smell. I think they changed like the perfume they put on the Max at the factory or something, but it smells really good. It's like a new car.
Glad to hear it.
Well, given the price, I guess it should smell like a new car.
Maybe it's like when you buy that more expensive computer, they put the more expensive perfume on it.
Right. So let's see some numbers.
Let's do it.
Right. I did some very quick testing here. Absolutely, like, not scientific. It's just like for my own curiosity, basically. But let's look at AirBuddy build numbers first. So AirBuddy is significantly large project, but definitely not even close to like what someone working for like a big tech company with a big app would face. Few dependencies and all of that stuff, but it is a sizable project. So a clean debug build of AirBuddy on the latest shipping Xcode as of the moment on my M1 Max 14-inch MacBook Pro took 44 seconds. And it actually doesn't sound like a long time, but every time I have to do a clean build, it feels like an eternity. But I was actually surprised that it's just 44 seconds. It felt longer. And on my M2 Max, that's 36 seconds. So did a bit of a difference there. 8 seconds. I'm saving 8 seconds, John.
Yeah. It feels like it's going to take a little while to recoup that investment, to be honest. But but still, I'm happy for you that you're saving seconds, but maybe not as dramatic difference as I was hoping for.
Right. Definitely not dramatic. However, over time, so this is just like, oh, if you had put $1 in a savings account back in 1989, you would be a millionaire. but I did some math here, like, and this is, of course, it's all estimates from, like, I don't count how many times a day I build AirBuddy or clean builds versus incremental builds. The performance gain on an incremental build was 5 seconds, so a little bit less than a clean build, which makes sense. On archive builds, so like a full release archive build, the difference was 15 seconds, so the new one does it in 15 seconds less. So doing a bit of estimation on how many times I do each one of these things, in a month, I am saving 2 hours and 40 minutes.
All right. Yeah. Well, again, it's going to take a while to recoup that investment.
Over a year, that would be a saving of 1 day, 10 hours, 50 minutes, and 24 seconds.
All right.
So yeah, not like mind-blowing. I'm definitely going to do more testing on other things that I do. Like I edit this podcast, which takes a while, like to apply effects and things like that. I'm curious to see if I'm going to notice any difference in there. But yeah, definitely not mind-blowing as of now. But I should probably also do, like you mentioned, the recouping the investment. I should probably actually do the math in terms of money and see how that goes But yeah, I'm a bit scared to do that.
Yeah, I will say, like, no offense to you, Rambo, and of course anyone can upgrade whenever they want and you know, spend their time and resources on whatever they want. But I am very happy with my M1 Max. I think I'll stay with that one for now.
Of course, we know that the main reason why I got this Mac is because I wanted to.
Right. And that's, you know, that's, if you have the means, then, you know, have fun, right? Like, yeah. That's all your decision.
Absolutely. But yeah, I'm happy with it. This also weighed into my decision, but I was in the mood for a larger display on my laptop as well. I got the 14-inch when I got this first M1 Max MacBook Pro because I felt like I wanted the portability, but I don't travel that much. Like, it's like once or twice per year, and like this year I went on vacation for 2 weeks and I didn't bring my laptop because, of course, I was on vacation. But if I'm going to a conference, like, it's not that big a deal to carry a 16-inch versus a 14-inch laptop. Of course, it's bigger, it's heavier, but it fits in the backpack that I use, so that's fine. But when I'm at home, in my office, I use my studio display and the Mac in clamshell mode. But if I'm working anywhere else in the house, and I do work quite frequently from upstairs and things like that, I am using the laptop, and I was feeling like I had too little space on the screen, especially using like SwiftUI previews, or if I wanted to like work on an app that has a backend, so I have like the backend code in Visual Studio Code and the front end in Xcode, and juggling all of those windows in a 14-inch display was starting to become annoying for me and lowering my productivity. So that's the sort of productivity you can't really measure, right? I can't measure how many hours I'm saving from not having to keep managing the positioning of windows or scrolling or things like that.
Yeah, and like you said, like, it doesn't have to be just like measurable either. Like, if you prefer a 16-inch display, you prefer a 16-inch display, right? Like, it's some of these things also just comes down to preference. Like, it's not, you just can't put data on it. Like, it's not like build times that is just, you can measure it and say, oh, this was 10 seconds faster or 5 seconds faster. It's just, you know, what you prefer at the moment. And, you know, a lot of people I find can swing back and forth between the two. Like, sometimes in your life, you're traveling a lot and you feel like you want something a bit more lightweight. I was definitely like that. Like, remember when I was working 100% on the iPad when I was traveling, right? Because I was mostly like writing articles and sample code and doing some code reviews and stuff for clients and writing some code samples here and there. And for that, the iPad was working fine. But now when I'm working as a freelancer pretty much full time, I am not traveling maybe as much, even though sometimes I find like using a MacBook Pro like this is, you know, definitely the best tool for me. But I still prefer the 14-inch form factor just as a kind of preference thing. So that's also a big factor, I feel like, is kind of, you know, you can change your mind over time, what you prefer, and it's a lot about personal preference.
Yeah, I probably wouldn't be doing this change if I already had the 16-inch, then I probably wouldn't do this. So all of those tiny factors added up to, okay, I think it's going to be worth it for me to do this upgrade. But if my previous one was already a 16-inch, or if I wasn't in the market for a 16-inch, then I probably wouldn't have gotten this one. The screen was a big factor in my decision, especially because I like to use the true 2x resolution, which used to be the default, but for a while now the default resolution on these laptops is not the 2x one, the true like 2x one. Hey there, this is Rambo from the future speaking. So I was actually totally wrong about the 2x display resolution thing. On the recent Apple Silicon Macs, they actually come with a default resolution already set to what is the actual true 2x Retina resolution. So there's no need to change any of that. Not sure why I got that confused, but just so you know, if you get a recent Apple Silicon laptop, it comes pre-configured with the quote correct resolution. And now back to the show. And when you move to that true 2x one, you do lose a little bit of screen real estate. And in the 16-inch, that makes less of a difference.
Yeah, exactly. Again, it depends on what you prefer. Like, the if you are fine with some screen scaling and the look being a little bit more soft, right? Because you get that kind of super sampling effect that generates a little bit more of a softer image, then that's cool. But if you want that, you know, pristine, complete retina, then, you know, you can either have larger UI elements on the screen or, you know, get a bigger screen, essentially.
Right. And I'm telling everyone, if you use your Mac not in this mode that I talked about, which is not the default, so if you've never changed it, don't change it to the, like, true 2x mode, because you're not going to want to change it back. Because at least, like, for me, I just can't use it. It looks awful to my eyes. Like, everything looks blurry and scaled. I like the true 2x. Like, I like my pixels to be extra crispy.
Yeah, so do I.
So I know that you've got some new hardware as well.
Yes, I do. And it's not a new Mac, because like I mentioned, I am very, very happy with my M1 Max. In fact, I was just traveling over the weekend and I brought it with me. And I was just thinking to myself, like, this computer still feels new to me. Like, it still feels like a fresh, nice new computer, because I haven't actually been using it that much as a laptop. Of course, I take it to meetings sometimes here and there. And, you know, I do work sometimes around the house, but most of the time I just work here in my office and then I'm connected to my external display and I don't really use it as a laptop that much. So whenever I do travel now these days, it's so nice and I get to use it like the whole thing, right? The screen and everything, the keyboard, which is, you know, I always get reminded of how nice the new keyboards are on the laptops, especially compared to the butterfly keyboards that were before. So traveling with the MacBook Pro these days is just such a nice thing. And the battery life also keeps impressing me, where I was traveling over the weekend and I left home on Friday and I didn't charge the computer until Sunday. And I was actually using it every day. So it's really cool, like, how you can now get quite far on a single charge on the new MacBook Pros as well. So yeah, just a reminder that the MacBook Pro is really great, at least in my opinion. So speaking of external displays, that's actually my new hardware. So I have been using the same 4K Samsung display for, I think, like about 10 years or something, or maybe 8 years, quite a while. As longtime listeners of the show will know, I do tend to keep my hardware running for a long time. I think my TV, until I upgraded, was going on 16 years, something like that. And of course, I had a MacBook Pro previous to my Mac Mini, which was also going for, I think, 5-6 years, something like that. So I do tend to keep my hardware running for quite a while before I upgrade, because I do want that, like, big leap when I do upgrade, right? Nice. I think we're sometimes a little bit different in that, me and you, Rambo. You want the latest and greatest, and I'm happy to wait.
I'm like that with the Apple Watch. Last time I got the latest one, which was last year, I felt that leap, even though it was, like, just my previous one was just one generation behind, but there were significant changes where I felt that, oh, this is significant.
Yeah, exactly. Like, that is such a nice feeling when you, like, it's transformative, right? Like, when you use the new product, like, that's usually what I'm looking for, is that I want to feel like with the, like I mentioned earlier, when I got the M1 Mac Mini, it really transformed the way I work. And all of a sudden, like, I could do things so much faster than before. So that's kind of usually what I'm looking for.
Right.
So I did decide to upgrade my monitor, and the first thing that you could consider as a Mac user, of course, is Apple's monitors, right? Like, Apple has the studio display and they've also got the XDR display as well, right? Mm-hmm. None of these two are really good options for me. The XDR is, I don't need all of that. Like, extreme dynamic range, it's way above my budget as well in terms of price. So that one I ruled out very, very quickly. The studio display also really wasn't for me for two major reasons. The first one is that actually, because it's 5K, I actually don't want a 5K monitor because of compatibility with other things other than Macs. Right. Which is, for example, I want to be able to use it with my Windows PC. I want to be able to use it with things like game consoles and other devices that I want to be able to plug in easily. And 5K is very much like an Apple thing, right?
Well, and 5K is not even the issue in that case. Thunderbolt only and just one port is the big issue, because that's
exactly
all you
that's
get.
That was going to be the second thing, right? So right. That is a very big issue. And of course, if you're only using your display with a Mac, it's super convenient, right? You just plug that one cable in and you've got charging, you've got display, you've got USB and so on, right?
Right.
So I'm not at all saying here like that the Studio Display is a bad monitor. It just wasn't for me, right? That's not what I wanted.
It's great for people like me who just wants to be able to come to the office, plug in my Mac with a single cable and have everything. But for anyone else, it's not. If you want to plug one more thing into the Studio Display, forget it.
Exactly. So I wanted something with a lot more ports, but it's still a nice experience. And another third reason, actually, why I didn't want to use the Studio Display is that I've decided that I really wanted something with a higher refresh rate than 60 hertz. Because if I look around in the different screens that I'm using now these days, so I'm using my iPhone, my iPad, my MacBook Pro now, they all have these super nice 120 hertz screens, including my TV as well. And even though I'm not always like consuming content or gaming or whatever it might be at 120 hertz, even though that's something I'm doing more and more often now since I moved to gaming on my PC, it's so nice to have that fluid refresh rate. And I think anyone who's been using like an iPhone Pro and then goes back to like a test device that is 60 hertz, it feels almost like it's lagging, right? Like it feels much more unresponsive and you know, not as smooth. And of course, it doesn't mean that devices with 60 hertz are unusable, not at all. It's just that if I could get it, I would like to have 120 hertz now minimum on all my screens. So I did a bunch of research, like a lot of research actually, because again, the huge benefit of buying into the Apple ecosystem is that you don't have so many choices, right?
Right.
You have to just choose what Apple has to offer and that's it. When you go above or outside the Apple bubble, then you have so many choices and there are so many standards and so many things you have to look into and so many things you have to research. And USB-C as well, like the whole USB-C standard, it's so confusing. And I had to figure out like, you know, does this display even connect to my Mac with USB-C? Like, will I be able to get high refresh rate at 4K with HDR and so on? Will this all work? It was a lot of work actually to do all of this research. And eventually I decided on the Sony InZone M9, which is actually like a gaming monitor. And it's actually like kind of designed in a similar way to the PlayStation 5. Like it has a very peculiar design, which at first when I saw it was kind of off-putting. Like it has a very specific stand design. But so when I did eventually decide to buy it, then I was 100% sure that I would use it with like a Vesa mount with a monitor arm or something as to not have to use that stand. But then once I got it and I actually put it on my desk, I actually realized that I actually really love the stand. Like it looks really, really cool in person and just fitting here on my desk as well. I've got like white accents on my desk and I've got this like light bamboo desk. And the white kind of accents on the monitor itself, like it all looks really, really nice. So I've actually decided to keep the stand. So now I have a Mac, a PC, and an Xbox connected to a PlayStation monitor, which I find to be kind of funny.
Yeah, I'm looking at the display here, and I must say I have the same impression of the stand. Like the initial impression is, what's that?
Yeah, exactly. And I feel like a lot of people have that same impression of the PlayStation 5 as well when they first saw it, right? Like it's very big, right? It has a very stated design. Like the design is trying to make a statement, right?
Right.
And the same thing is true here as well. But yeah, I've just grown to kind of really like the design, but maybe I will still mount it on an arm like later just to save some desk space, but for now, I'm keeping the stand. So first impressions, I've only had this monitor for about a week. I really, really love it. Like when I first got it, it was kind of like the colors and everything was a little bit like oversaturated. So I did have to do a little bit of calibration. I had to change some picture modes. I did some HDR calibration as well using my Windows PC actually, because Windows has a really, really good HDR calibration tool built in. So I used that. And now it's like running really well. And I think I've actually got it to almost like match the colors on my MacBook Pro display, which I 100% could not do on my previous display because it just didn't have that color range and that brightness. And having like an HDR display as well with really good brightness is really nice. And the fact also that it I could plug it in with a Thunderbolt 4 cable. So I abandoned the USB-C stuff because it was just so confusing. And I just decided, let me just get a Thunderbolt 4 cable because that supports like all of the USB-C standards. It supports like the latest DisplayPort standard. So I can just plug that in as a USB-C cable into my monitor and I get 4K at 144 hertz, which is just super nice. And then I still have ports left over for all my other devices, which is great. And I can also use it as a USB hub. So I've plugged in my like my webcam and other kind of devices into the monitor. And that all works through that one USB-C cable as well. It only has 15 watts of power, though. So I do still have to put my MagSafe cable in as well for actual charging. But right. I'm fine with that. But overall, like super happy with this monitor. And it took so long to like decide on getting this one because there were, again, so many different products on the market, but they all like it was hard to find one that I felt like ticked all the boxes. There was either like design issues or like the HDR was lacking or the colors were lacking or it was too big or there were so many different connections that were missing. Like there were so many different things to research. So at the end, I'm very happy with this purchase.
And what's the Mac experience like with a display like this one? Because I remember when people were talking about Apple maybe bringing promotion to the Mac when it was just a rumor, there was a lot of discussion around how that would work for external displays and that it was impossible to do for external displays. So do you get high refresh rate with a Mac using this display with a Thunderbolt cable?
Yeah, I do. So I get the full 144 hertz and it's all scrolling super smoothly. There is even an option to run it in VRR, which would be the same as Apple's ProMotion, which is essentially VRR, right?
Oh, interesting. It's
a little bit different, right? Because ProMotion, I think, is more kind of integrated in the OS where it kind of knows what content you're viewing and adapts the refresh rate to that. With VRR, you get just kind of, if you're running full screen and something is drawing directly to like the display buffer, that's when you get the VRR, like it will only draw the frames that it's rendering. But yeah, you do get the full 144 hertz and it's super smooth. So that experience is working really well. And I know you were surprised to hear that when I first told you about that, that you could even run an external display at 144 hertz from a Mac, right?
Right. Yeah. I think the issue is when you go above 4K.
Exactly.
Yeah. So above 4K, that would not be very easy to do. And that's where the big problem is for Apple because they want 5K at least. So yeah.
Exactly. And it's worth also talking about why does Apple actually want 5K, right? Because right. I think that's sometimes a little bit confusing. Like, why is 5K so much better than 4K? Like, is 4K not crisp enough? And it all comes down to what size you want your UI to run in. So 5K is 2 times 1440p, right? Mm-hmm. And 4K is 2 times 1080p. So what we would usually call full HD back in the day, right? And I think 1440p has been kind of marketed as QHD these days.
Right.
So that's kind of the different resolutions. And so what it all comes down to is like, how big do you want your UI to look? So now when I'm running my 4K display, and this was true also with my previous one, I'm running it in retina mode, essentially. I'm running it with pixel doubling. So all my screen actually looks like 1080p in terms of real estate, but it's crisp as a retina display because I have 2x, so I'm running it at 4K. And the distance I have my monitor from my face, it looks just as crisp to me as my MacBook Pro screen. So I don't have the best eyesight, but you know, it's good enough for me. So with 5K, the main benefit you get is not necessarily extra crispness, but you get more screen real estate because you can run it in 1440p at 2x instead of 1080p. But then again, I'm fine with that because I like my UI to be a bit larger anyway. In fact, when I'm running with Windows, I'm actually running Windows at 300% UI size because I like things to be a little bit larger. So that's, again, personal preference. But yeah, you're absolutely right. Like the reason they can't yet, with the current like DisplayPort standards and Thunderbolt and so on, do 5K at 120 hertz is just because of the bandwidth. Because even at 4K, you need Display Stream Compression, or DSC. I think with the current technology and with the current standards, you just couldn't get up to 5K at, you know, 120 or 144 hertz 4K is kind of the limit right now.
Right, so that explains it. But yeah, sounds like you got a really sweet setup there. I think the main downside that I can see is the fact that you don't get power from the monitor, but that's a small price to pay given all of the benefits, given you want to have all of that stuff with a single display and be able to switch between them. So I think you got a nice setup going there.
Yeah, the two most important things for me really were color and refresh rate. Like, I wanted something with really nice vivid colors with good P3 color space coverage, which this monitor has. And I wanted something with really high refresh rate so I could get that smooth scrolling experience that I'm now really used to on my MacBook Pro, my iPad, and my iPhone, and so on. And with all those things, it really lives up to that. So again, it comes down to like, what do you want? Like, what is the most important to you, right? If you want that single cable experience, then probably like the Apple display is the best one. But if you want, like I wanted, like some different kind of aspects to your display, then something like this Sony InZone monitor is really, really nice. And there are also like quite a lot of different products now on the market, especially if you don't really care much about HDR, then there's quite a lot of good displays now from LG and Samsung and so on that can do like 4K at 144 hertz over USB-C and DisplayPort and different cables. So yeah, the monitor situation is looking better and better, I feel like, both for Mac and PC users.
Awesome.
Just make sure you get the right cable. Get the Thunderbolt cable if in doubt, because USB-C cables, they're so confusing. It's so confusing to figure out, like, do they actually support DisplayPort 1.4 or is it just DisplayPort 1.3, which is not enough for 4K 120 hertz? Oh, it's very confusing. So Thunderbolt to the rescue. All right. So I think this is it for this software hardware mix episode of Stacktrace. So hope you enjoyed it. And like always, if you did enjoy the show, feel free to tell us about it. You can reach us on Mastodon. I am at JohnsonDell at mastodon.social. And Mr. Rambo, where can people find you?
I'm at _inside on mastodon.social.
There we go. And of course, a special thanks to this episode's sponsor, NordVPN. You can check them out at nordvpn.com/stacktrace. And of course, thank you so much for listening, everybody. And we will talk to you again next month. Say goodbye, Mr. Rambo.
Goodbye.